Resurrected Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
The Combined Security Services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine components of signals intelligence. That's why the director of NSA is military, because he oversees all of that. So I got into that way, and that's how signals intelligence basically is looking at how the comment side, it really breaks, signals intelligence breaks down into two parts, communications intelligence and what they call ELINT, electronic intelligence. Communications is simply people communicating, however they do it, whether it's with the microwaves or with the radio or telephone or emails or any way people communicate, that's communications intelligence. That's that you collect that information to try to analyze what they're doing and figure out what their intentions and capabilities are. That's what the intelligence community is supposed to do. On the ELINT side, that's kind of radars, the where is a flying object or where is a ship at sea or telecommunication, the telemetry with satellites and things and missiles and how are they operating and how are they, what are they developing? So that's that kind of intelligence, like machine talking to machine. That's that kind of intelligence. So that's how SIGINT breaks down.
How many years did you spend in the Army before you joined NSA?
I was 4 years in the Army, and then I went from, I got out of the Army in 69 and started in 1970 at NSA. And I was with them till 2001, so almost 32 years.
So you have about 36 or 37 years total service, 32 years approximately at the NSA, based around the analysis of data. Can you talk a little bit about the analysis of data as a discipline or a science or an art form and the importance of automation these days?
I looked at this is one of the problems I saw with the field of analysis, period, whether it was in NSA, CIA, or anywhere else. The point was it was variable by the analysts looking at it. That is, there wasn't underlying truth. It was just that other analysts wouldn't necessarily end up with the same result given the same input. That is, they wouldn't necessarily be able to see as far into the reality of what was happening as there would be varying views of that depending on the analyst you went to. So you get a distributed outcome across a spectrum of interpretations of the same data. to me, that was simply incompatible with what the analysis discipline should be. And so I started in 1985. I started working at NSA in a way to try to automate that process. Now, that meant you had to put together the basic understanding of how analysis operates. So you build rules of how to look at data, how to analyze data, how to put data together and construct an argument that would show a given implication from that input and be consistent and optimal. That is, if someone else had a better rule or a way to approach the data, you would look at that, take that in, and see if that was true, then you would incorporate it. So you were basically assembling and accumulating knowledge of the process and knowledge for a discipline that would cut across all agencies in the U.S. government as well as other governments around the world. So basically, I was the only one automating the analysis to that extent, trying to make it. Others would do data preparation kind of automation, that is correlating data that should be packaged together and then presenting it to an analyst to look at. Whereas I would say that that's simply the first step. The automation process then needs to continue beyond that to take that information and begin to understand what that means and begin to build interpretations and, in fact, in many cases, even write reports completely without human intervention and do it with a discipline that was consistent, accurate, and reliable. So that was my thrust at NSA. In fact, I was the only one there doing that kind of thing.
What is relationship mapping and how is it useful in taking raw data and making it, information?
Well, I think there's a little history to this. Maybe should go into a little bit of the history here.
Absolutely.
Because this is not unique to this time and age. Actually, it goes back many years. You can go back even to the Revolutionary War. But I like the case in Washington when they when I think it was the Pinkertons figured out the Confederate spy ring in Washington D.C. simply by watching people visit other people. So they built up a relationship ring just by visitors who visited who, and so that laid out their network. And then they didn't call it social networking then. They just called it mapping the spy network. Then in World War I, when Manuel Morris, I believe at that point became the primary communications system for all the field armies in the European war. Then they called it net reconstruction, where you'd have call signs being used by military formations calling one another. And you would use those call signs as relationships to put back together the entire military structure of the opposing armies. And then you could watch them move around and you could see how they were preparing things for like an offensive, even before they started the artillery bombardment. So you could see those kinds of things too. And then later on, and after World War II, they did the same kind of thing there with many, many different means of communications, air to ground, as well as ship to ship, ship to shore, and ground to ground. So those kinds of communications helped them lay out the communications networks for the opposing armies and the Nazis and Japanese. But for example, it also gave them acquired data that they could break for the Enigma or in the JN-25, in the case of the Japanese JN-25 or the Purple Codes. So those kinds of things gave them that information to be able to defeat them. It made a big difference on the battlefield. But today, and at that time, they started calling it contact chaining. And it was still network reconstruction, but also in the form of contact chaining. A calls B, A calls C. So that's how you put back together your network. And the same today is done, except now they call it social network reconstruction. So here's your social network. You phone your mother, you phone your daughter, you phone your friends, your business partners. You go to work and you telephone the same people, but in different directions. So you get all those things into a network. And that's called your social network. And the same then applies to the internet, who you communicate with, or on Facebook, who you communicate with, and so on, or any communications means or media. It also applies to financial transactions when you use credit cards or write a check or pay a bill electronically. All those account-to-account transactions are a network for financial operations for you. And the same is true with travel. If you're going overseas, your passport number's identified, where you're going, what planes you get on, when you leave, when you arrive, all that's laid out, and that shows your travel network.
So in the past, it was social network reconstruction where they would try to figure out who you're friends with and this sort of thing. And today, it's voluntary self-surveillance, do-it-yourself surveillance by just putting on your Facebook or your Twitter. They don't have to actually come it's more of a – they can play defense because they don't have to be on offense. We're giving them the information. They just have to collect it and analyze it and predict our movements.
Right. And actually, they can take your address book off your internet or off your computer and lay out your whole network there using that data too. And that's been one of the recent ones there. But they don't even have to attack your computer. If you allow yourself to be open, they can get that information easily.
Bill, if we're the targets today, let's compare it and contrast to the NSA in the 1970s. Who were your targets back then? And what were your daily activities back then?
At the time, the bulk of NSA was focusing on foreign threats. So they didn't know about the Minaret program. What NSA does is they compartmentalize programs so that only very few people know about them or involved in them. There was a small percentage of people at NSA that were involved in program Minaret. So the vast majority of people there didn't know it was happening. And their activities were fundamentally trying to analyze the communications of foreign countries or foreign governments and militaries, and to try to assess potential adversaries, threats, and so on. I mean, the main focus, again, was at that time in 1970, was on the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact as the prominent, preeminent kind of threat that we were facing. But also we had efforts against Red China, North Korea, Cuba, and various other countries around the world that were borderline potential threats. So that it depended. I mean, you had a national priority list for intelligence production, so you would follow that primarily as your targeting for effort that you would devote in terms of signals intelligence. So it was the national intelligence, these SIGINT national SIGINT requirement lists were developed from national requirements for intelligence based on the view of the U.S. government around, of other governments and militaries and or terrorist organizations and things like that around the world.
How about in the 1980s? Who was the NSA pointing its barrel at? Who were the targets? Is it the Soviet Union still during the Cold War, or who?
Yeah, during the Cold War, it was still the primary ones were the Soviet Union, Warsaw Pact, China, and North Korea were the primary ones. But over time, that was changing. There were some terrorist activities early in the Reagan administration in Lebanon, for example. Others, so there was a raising that as another issue. So they're starting to look at terrorism as an issue, and so there was a little shift starting there. But still, primarily, they were focused externally at foreign threats. And after the Church Committee investigations, the Minaret program was terminated, and the FISA law was enacted, and they adopted the program Blarney, I think, as a result of the FISA laws. And that was, again, they were very sensitive at that point from there on about any collection of U.S. citizens. I mean, if you happened to have some data collected about a U.S. citizen, right away you had to review it for as whether or not it was a violation of the FISA law. And either way, you had to purge the data from the base. So we were very sensitive at that time about that.
So after the Church Committee, the FISA courts, those are protections put in to protect the individual rights of people in this country. We call them citizens. In 1992, John Taggart led a problem-solving team to combine ops and research to capture and diagnose data. Could you describe the substance and nature of what that project was?
Actually, it was a joint. Dr. Taggart came from research. He was the chief of staff of the research area over there, and he came in. Actually, I met him first in 1985 when we started cooperating there to do automation of SIGINT processes. So the analysis was the driving factor of that. So we were working together from 1985 to about 1982 when we said, with the explosion of the digital world and digital communications, why we felt that at that time we had to formalize the kind of loose cooperation we've been doing together since 1985. So we started jointly the SIGINT Automation Research Center. John came from research, and so he brought all the technical skills, computer processing people, engineers, even physicists or other people who had the technical skills from the technology area. And I came from operations, so I had the operational skills like linguists, analysts, crypto mathematicians, cryptanalysts, and so on. So I'd bring all that into that effort too. So we had all the skills at NSA kind of in a small area. It was only about 16 people total. And so we were all in one place. And so it made it much easier to attack problems, because what you would do to get together, now here's the problem we want to attack, and you define that problem for everybody. And we'd say, here is your component of that problem, and here's yours, and here's yours, and here's how you all have to work together to solve the problem to get the end result. So everybody would know their part in what the effort was. They would know what they were contributing, who they had to work with, and what the end result was. So they knew the entire process from beginning to end. And it gave that understanding having that understanding and the people developing it made it so much easier to integrate and so much quicker to solve. And so that was the whole idea of the SIGINT automation. It's like a Skunk Works or a Saturn plant, for example, how you can quickly solve the problem and do it effectively.
What's the right way to use spying to protect freedom and liberty? In other words, what should be done and how can we be protected and still, you know, do the job of collecting the intelligence we need?
What we did was we looked at it as we had to satisfy all the legal requirements under the FISA laws and all the other laws that existed, plus abide and protect the constitutional rights of everyone, every citizen of the United States. At the same time, we wanted also to be making our analysts effective against foreign threats. That meant getting and focusing in on a rich environment of information to ensure that that would happen. I mean, if we buried them in data, they were already buried in data when we started this program, and they were malfunctioning at that time, and they were complaining about that. And all they were doing was coming in with more and more tools for them to use to look at data. That didn't solve the problem of all the massive amount of data that they had to look at, and the ways that they were going at it. They were going at it from a Google-type approach where you use a series of words or a phrase or something to go at, and many people use those phrases that aren't even related or involved in any activity that was of concern. So what that did was bury them under a pile of useless information, even in the 90s. So the question was how to solve that problem and do it effectively, so that we, followed all the rules of law and also abided the constitutional rights and made a rich environment for our analysts to look at, to analyze, and become much more effective in their jobs and their responsibilities and what they're attempting to do. So that's what our whole program that out of the SIGINT Automation Center was all about, and that's what we tried to do, and that's effectively what we did. And we did it by doing a focused, targeted approach in terms of the graphing of relationships, social networks. We would build the social networks of the bad guys and also look at the social networks that were being passed as data was passing by so that we could see whether or not someone was a part of that network or not. If they were not, we simply let everything pass right by. So that meant that gave privacy not only to U.S. citizens but to everybody in the world. And it made a rich environment then of data for analysts to look at. And on top of that then, if we found that someone in the United States, assumed U.S. citizen, was in way cooperating or communicating with some terrorist organization or member of a terrorist organization overseas, we would initially, when we picked them up, we would encrypt all the attributes that identified them, so that basically they would be anonymized. But you could still track them and follow what they were doing because it was unique anonymization. So that meant we could track them, but still not be able to tell who they were until we would develop probable cause. At that point, then we would say we would get a warrant, and then we would be authorized to target them and take in their data. If we didn't have a warrant, we simply would terminate that activity after, I think it was 3 days, 72 hours. You had 72 hours to get a warrant to do that.
In 1997, what was your position at NSA?
I was the technical director of what I call the world. I was the technical director of the intelligence production of the comments side of the NSA, which basically encompassed the entire world. It was an operation of about 6,000 people, and they were analysts and linguists and reporters of all the material collected by NSA for militaries, governments, whatever in the world. So that was where I was then. That's why I got into doing the digital age and solving that problem for NSA.
Well, and from what I could pick up from the story, in the 90s, after you and Ed Loomis had worked for Taggart, Loomis took over his position, and some of the things or some of the projects or components that you guys had worked on were brought together into something called Thin Thread.
This is the most transparent administration in history. Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Could you talk about how it was supposed to be an automated analysis of the network log, why that would have worked, and why, because it worked, it wouldn't be accepted?
Okay, that was a separate proposal we had made to automate the network log, analyzing the network log. When we formed the SIGINT Automation Research Center as one of the first things we wanted to do. Everything that anybody does on a computer or on a network in NSA or anywhere else gets logged in the network log. So if you click a mouse and it sends a set of instructions down the network to a point where you are going to get data or something, that gets logged in the log. So we wanted to put together an automated process to analyze the log in near real time, to be able to say what people are doing on the network as they did it. So in other words, if somebody came on the network and started to download all kinds of files, we would pick that up within milliseconds of it happening. And after a point alert to that, and for example, Snowden, if we had had that in process, online, we wanted to monitor everybody in the world, so we would have included Snowden or anybody in the world, anywhere in the world, who was coming on the NSA network. If they came on and started to do something, we would know about it and be able to learn about it. So if that would have been running, Snowden couldn't have done without what he did without being picked up almost immediately.
But if that were running, and Snowden wouldn't have had to blow the whistle in the first place, because the integrity of the NSA would be preserved, right, through that program, which could monitor the budgets, right, and all sorts. Go ahead, Nick.
And we ran into two problems, two camps of opposition to that. The first one were the analysts. Because once you start monitoring what the analysts are doing on the network, you know how they're operating. You can say, this analyst needs some training in this area because they're not quite doing the problem right, you know, or this analyst has an idea that worked and we need to spread it around, so we'll take advantage of that. And that group of analysts said, we do not want you monitoring us. We'll do our job. Thank you. You just go about your business and don't pay any attention to us. So, but that was not the major group that opposed us. The major group were all the managers. And the reason they did that was because this will show return on investment on every program they're funding. And whether or not programs that are being funded are being successful or not, and whether or not they're contributing. So that would set up a whole process for return on investment assessment for NSA, also for Congress, because that would be evidence for Congress to review in terms of what kinds of funding they would do for the agency. So that meant, plus it took away the freedom that the managers felt they had to move money around and do anything they had with money, because we'd pick that up too. So that said to them, I don't want you monitoring me. I want the freedom to do what I want to do as I want to do it. So go away and we're not going to do this. So that's why we didn't do that back in the early 90s.
Well, and without audit oversight, fraud and corruption become the status quo.
Yeah, that's the main issue here, that the NSA and CIA and intelligence community in general is not audited. That is, there's no accounting for how they spend the money, how effectively or not. So it's a setup for corruption and fraud and waste.
Volume, velocity, and variety. Asset or liability?
The way we looked at it in the SIGIN Automation Research Center was that volume meant you had the opportunity to get more information about your target, simply because there was more of it out there. And velocity meant you got it at the speed of light, so that was good. And variety meant you got many aspects of it. You get voice, maybe video, maybe Twitter or else email, and all kinds of aspects. So all those things we looked at as positive things, all we had to do was figure out how to manage them.
Let's talk about ThinThread a little bit and how it at one time protected the rights and privacy rights, especially of American citizens.
Yeah, well, in the data acquisition system, once we acquired information and recognized that maybe a terrorist was talking to a potential U.S. citizen, what we would do is encrypt all the attributes. So that would protect their identities until you could show probable cause. You had a certain time limit to do that. That was automatically managed by the system by software right up front. So that as data, if data was just about U.S. citizens, the software would simply let it pass right by. It would never be ingested into our system. So it had to be that targeted set of individuals that we were after, and maybe 2 degrees, we were going to expand that to the 2 degrees around it as the zone of suspicion in the social network. Otherwise, we wouldn't even take in the data. And that would be filtered by software up front as as that data was viewed. It's much similar to what Naris and the Verint devices for AT&T and Verizon can do today.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's in the next line of thinking. Is February 2001, AT&T and Verizon get these pieces of paper from the government saying, we want your customer data. AT&T used something called a Naris device, and I'm sure there's an equivalent device at Verizon. I'm not sure what it's called.
It's Verint, yeah.
And what do these devices do specifically? And this was, again, February 2001, am I correct?
February, Naris didn't, I think, start marketing things till about 2002. Before that, in 2001, early on, they were going around soliciting information from different telecommunications companies. The one we know about that.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extendivite is more than just a heart tonic. Most basic diseases are caused by yeast in the gut and metals in the liver, and we all have a bit of both. The garlic in Extendivite has a yeast-killing effect in the gut while also helping the sulfur enzyme in the liver get rid of the metals. Extendivite just may improve your overall health. Products like Extendivite are the only way we are going to get our society healthy. And if you're waiting for the government and pharmaceutical care to solve your health problems, you're going to have a long, disappointing wait, I think. Extendivite is a complete formula for extended life in the new millennium. 80 can be the new 60. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a two-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Is in court record is Quest. Nacho, who was the CEO of Quest at the time, refused to turn over all of their data. This they approached him on the 27th of February, according to the court records of 2001, which was about seven months before 9/11. So they were approaching them before 9/11 to get all of their data, all of their customer information. So the intent that was kind of implied, the intent was to get information on U.S. citizens even before 9/11. The key point about when they were approached is that we had proposed to deploy our system in November of 2000, just 3 or 4 months before they made this approach to Quest. Because we had everything connected and everything was functioning all the way back through the big ass graph, if you will, the bag, or the social networking for everybody that was ingested. And we had projected at the time we had no limit as to how many trillions of transactions we could take in, that we could still manage them with this process that we put together. The idea was if you took in trillions of relationships that, like phone calls between people, but when you boiled it down to, you would only get tens of billions of maybe relationships uniquely, and that all the others would simply be repeats of those tens of billions of relationships. So we would put together a system that would build the relationship and then keep a counter of how many times we had a record of that relationship, rather than keep the entire list of if we saw something 1,000 times, we would simply have it once and say we saw it 1,000 times, as opposed to listing it 1,000 times. So that's how we could boil it down to a small set of information and keep it in a rather compact set of storage. And that's how we projected we could graph everything, every transaction in the world that way, so that we didn't have a problem with storage and we didn't see a limit as to how much we could graph, and we used it and put it together in a B plus tree type index, which meant we had fast access to it to make decisions as data was passing by on whether or not we should keep that data. So that's how we fundamentally did it, using a B trust tree kind of index query to keep up with the velocity of things in the fiber network. And any time we started to get pressed in terms of CPU time or processing, we would simply add another processor and simply split the process and make it manageable again. So it was only a matter, the only thing that kept us from doing any amount of data was how much space and power do you have available, and we can buy the equipment to make that happen.
So prior to 9/11, AT&T and Verizon had complied with the government. This pre-9/11 collection of data means that the post-9/11 surveillance of the American citizens has nothing to do with 9/11 so much as they just wanted control and they wanted to break into these fiber optic networks, and AT&T, Verizon, they complied, and Joseph Nocio from Quest said no. What happened to him?
He ended up in jail. I think they went at him. He claims he was framed. I don't doubt it, because they attempted to frame me too, except they didn't succeed. I mean, I had evidence to show that it was a frame job and that it was malicious prosecution on their part, but evidently he couldn't do that. So he ended up in jail, I don't know how many, couple of years, I think. So he recently got out of jail. I think that simply meant that they used 9/11 as the way they could intimidate Congress into making it happen, to allow them to do that. And that's the way they did it. Originally, they had to keep it so secret because they knew they wouldn't be permitted by Congress or the courts to do it if they didn't keep it secret. So they allowed only four members of Congress to know about it. That were the chairs and ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. That was it. And those people bought into it. One of those was Nancy Pelosi. She later became Speaker of the House, and since she bought into all these programs, these programs were the grounds of impeachment for Richard Nixon. Except it was only, he was doing an infinitesimal amount compared to what's going on now, and he was impeached for that. So they all knew the dangers here, and they all tried to put together a mask of having the president authorize it and having the attorney general say it's legal, and keeping all that documentation secret out of the courts and away from the courts, so that nobody could challenge it. Nobody even knew it was happening. And that's why I started to blow the whistle at that time, because I went to the House Intelligence Committee staffer that I knew, Diane Rourke, and told her what was going on so that she would be aware. I mean, that committee was formed, and their charter was to ensure that this kind of activity did not happen. And so that's where I went first.
So just to summarize, prior to 9/11, the NSA was collecting billions of phone records on American citizens without probable cause, that they had kind of planned on doing this from the beginning, and then they used 9/11 as an excuse to really ramp that up. Is that
I think they were approach to Nocio would imply that they were planning on doing it before 9/11. What they did was they used 9/11 as the excuse or the basis for implementing it. That is, I didn't know that it was implemented until the second week in October of 2001. So that was after a little over a month after 9/11 had happened. So they started taking in that data at that time. And I only knew about it because the people who had worked for me to put together that system were the ones they had to use to set it up for Stellar Wind program, the domestic spying program. So they were the ones they had to use, and so they used them to do that. They would implement the code, make sure the code was functioning and the inputs would come in and it got processed properly. They were the only ones who knew the code sufficient enough to be able to do that. And so once they started ingesting data, they saw the data coming in. It was all about U.S. citizens. From AT&T, it was roughly averaged around 320 million records of long-distance phone calls between U.S. citizens inside the country every day. That didn't count all the other communications they were managing, too. But the domestic spying started with that. And then, of course, it branched out to other telecoms, and then they spread out. The only two things that the telecommunications companies had to offer, one was all the records of the phone calls and transactions that their customers were doing, and the other was access to the fiber lines. And giving that access to fiber lines allowed the NSA to use NARUS devices and other kinds of devices to tap into the networks and take, for example, all of the communications in the fiber optic lines for the World Wide Web. That's part of what Mark Klein exposed in the AT&T facility in San Francisco, was the NSA room where they had the NARUS devices operating in the off the fiber lines that the AT&T was managing. What they would do was, as Mark would explain it, simply put basically a prism on the fiber line, which would split the fiber into two parts, two equal parts. They would send one the normal way and then one to the NSA room.
Now that prism's basically a beam splitter?
It's basically a beam splitter. We call it a splitter or a Y connector.
Sure. So optically, they're taking one stream of fiber optic data, they're splitting it into two, they're capturing one, delivering you the other that you don't know is being spied on.
Right.
And they have had this ability for, you know, since last century, basically.
Yes. Actually, that capability goes back quite a ways. Using it effectively inside the United States started in after 9/11. So, and that was what Mark Klein exposed, and there are between 80 and 100 other similar tapping points inside the fiber network inside the United States in the Fairview program alone. In other programs, they have other tapping points with Stormview is another program, and then Blarney is another. So that those, and I'm not sure the extent of those, there is one slide on Stormbrew that shows tapping points along the periphery of the U.S., which would imply thereafter the transoceanic cables when they come up, which would imply that program is looking primarily for foreign communications, whereas Fairview looks much more like it's directed domestically.
StellarWind was one of these programs. Did it start prior to 9/11? And it's also a collaboration with GCHQ as well, where they're collecting information without probable cause and sharing it with other countries. Is that correct?
The StellarWind program was named, I think, in October of 2001 as their domestic spying program. That's when the data started coming in.
So right after 9/11, they said, we have a program for this. It's called StellarWind, and we just pulled it out of our pocket. It wasn't created before 9/11.
Right. That's right. And also, it wasn't shared with the British at that time. Although I think there's much more sharing going on now after, and more cooperation with law enforcement as well, sharing this kind of program, and they have similar programs in England, at least some of the stuff that Snowden materials come out saying the same thing, that they're doing that too. That's why I say this program, this kind of approach is spreading, and we're kind of the ones leading the way electronically. I think the British were doing it visually with the cameras and looking at their countrymen and monitoring what they were doing with the cameras before we were.
Mm-hmm.
But we started the electronic spying, and then now they're also joining us in that effort. I think we were much further ahead in them with them in doing that, in the graphing area, especially in indexing area and managing information. So I think they've adopted our technique. So.
So some of the relevant information pertaining to what the NSA had prior to 9/11 consists of communications that they've sniffed and stored and analyzed in some way. Was the NSA aware, or did it have in its databases the traffic that would have told us this attack is going to happen, and if so, what are the details?
Yes, although I don't see Tom Drake, who is a friend of mine, also a supporter of our program, ran that program on the entire NSA database after 9/11, several months afterward, and he found all the data that was necessary to stop 9/11 in their database sitting there that people didn't recognize or bring to anybody's attention or report in any form to anybody of authority. What that meant was that it got back to the unreliability of analysts being able to see through mounds of data, right? You make them dysfunctional by putting all that data on top of them and making them sift through it. And so, first of all, it's only humans can only do so much, and obviously there was just too much there for them to handle. That's why they needed an automated process going through it, and they didn't have that. They rejected that entire process. That's getting back to why I keep saying they traded the security of everybody in the United States and the free world for money, because they wanted to, money was the issue, not solving the problem.
So potentially NSA could have connected the dots prior to 9/11, stopped the terrorists from ever infiltrating the country, but they didn't have enough budget money, or they didn't focus that budget money on the appropriate projects. Which do you think it is?
Actually, it had nothing to do with the budget. They had plenty of a budget to do it. They didn't need any more money to make that happen. See, that was the issue. The issue was they wanted to build the budget up. They wanted more money. So you don't do anything that would take away the problem that you're using to get more money. So you stop that and keep the problem going is the issue, right? So you still have a problem, therefore I need more money, so you get a bigger budget. If they say, well, let's implement this other program that solved the problem, well, then they don't have that problem to argue for money. So, and that's basically the way they viewed it and the way they operated, and a lot of contractors got rich off of it.
Did you ever brief the CIA on what the NSA had on these terrorists prior to 9/11? So you would have briefed them after 9/11 and said, hey, here's what we had and here's what could have been known. Did that ever go on?
I left NSA in October of 2001, so any of the data that was run and pulled out by Tom Drake, he did after I left. So I couldn't brief CIA on that. But what I did do with Ed Loomis and Kirk Wiebe, we went through open source data in 2002 and pulled together all the material that was there, including the names of the targets of the terrorists. They had names for the targets, like the towers, the Twin Towers were called Town Center. The Capitol building was called Law, and the White House was called Fine Arts. And so they talked about these were the codes they used for the targets in emails and things that they had said. And we got this out of open source off the web using Google. So we did brief them on what we were able to pull out of open source. And that was as contractors, we were going in saying, this is what you can do with open source. And we went through that, and I say, how did you ever know all that? And I said, it's right there in open source, you know. You can get it too, you know. So, yes, we did brief them on that, but it was from open source material, not from anything that NSA had.
That's good to clarify. That's just good to clarify that it was from open source material. It was widely available. Right. Let me ask this specific question. Within that data set that was widely openly available, was the attack date of September 11th, 2001 in that correspondence to be found?
Yes, it was. Yeah. In fact, the way they depicted it as a, we say 9/11, ninth month, 11th day, but they'll say day, month. So they would put a line and a line and then a pie, a circle and a line. That would be 11/9. So the 11th day of nine of September. That was, that was mentioned as one of the date for the, event.
What was the response of the CIA when you demonstrated this ability from open source data?
They just couldn't believe that we got that information out of open source. They couldn't believe that it was there. That's all.
Did the FBI have access to that data as well?
At the time, I don't think at the time they did. I mean, NSA had that kind of information, so they didn't share that kind of data. Which they, of course, should. I mean, if that kind of information came to me when I was in the SIGINT Automation Research Center, if they didn't want to report it, I would pick up the gray phone, which is the encrypted phone for the U.S. government, and call somebody at CIA or FBI and say, here's what I have. Take action on it, will you? I can't seem to get it out of my place. You know, they don't want to report this, but here's what it is. I mean, you do those kinds of things when those kinds of important things. You don't care what your management says because this is just too important. you do those kinds of things. But there's very few people there. Most NSA employees would say, okay, we won't do that.
I asked about the FBI because they are in the unique position of being law enforcement and intelligence. And so a lot of times they sit in the middle and seem to play both sides of that identity game.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yep.
How is the USA Patriot Act a metaphorical Christmas list for the intelligence community and what they had planned to do, and now they're able to do it? Can you explain that process?
It's only possible by a secret interpretation of that act. The act does not say you can take bulk acquisition of information on U.S. citizens from all communications or any other means, from business records of anything. It simply says in there that you have the under Section 215 in the business records section, it says you can pursue investigating anything that's relevant to a terrorist investigation or dope smuggling, international dope smuggling, or anything like that. It doesn't say you have the right to take in everything and then try to sort it out later, which is the secret interpretation. The secret interpretation is not just relevant, it's potentially relevant. So that means everything. That's the way they interpret it. That's their secret interpretation. That the words don't say that, but that's the way they're using it.
So you're talking about Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. There's a secret interpretation. There's a secret court. How is this different than what went on in the Soviet Union that you used to fight against in the 70s and 80s?
Well, it really isn't. I mean, it's pretty much everything's determined in secret by a central government. The policy is set by the central government. Everybody toes the line, you know, follow the orders of the central government. It's like following orders, that, except that defense went out with Nuremberg, legally anyway.
What is cast iron in relation to Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act?
cast iron is separate. It's a separate thing. That means that the Section 215 simply says they're going to take in everything in bulk, all business records, so they've got records on everybody. If you get declared a cast iron target, that means they're going to go specifically at you for everything and manually review what you are doing, what you are saying, or any actions or movements you're making. So you will be specifically looked at by people, and not just processes, but by people. So it's a greater degree of focus of an intelligence effort against you and everything you do.
Well, and the purpose of them collecting everything we do is to make predictive models. And again, it goes back to population control, as you mentioned, not in the number of people on the planet, but controlling and being able to do that through the manipulation of their data and understanding their actions before they even take them. When you have such a large set of metadata being collected, isn't that just asking for them to encapsulate the skills of someone like yourself and put that into artificial intelligence so that they can have Bill Binney, even when Bill Binney doesn't want to work there anymore, they have your knowledge encapsulated and they're able to predictively model people in a way that learns using time series analysis and a bunch of other fancy techniques that basically takes in all this data and with a high predictability factor, they can tell you what you're going to be doing, what you're going to be eating. And I think some of the places are using this now for commercial marketing to tell, you know, they can predict where you're going to go from your Google searches and whatnot.
Yes. And unfortunately, that's the part that I never left with them. Okay. I never did that for them. So they didn't have that to be able to use it. That's why the president's big data initiative just help us find out what's important in this big data, because they can't do that. And that's really, it gets much more complicated when you, when you try to, to fuse, all the activities of individuals or groups of individuals into from multiple domains like phones and emails and travel and banking. And you try to merge all the activity of everyone, in that group or an individual alone, just trying to do that becomes much more involved and much more complicated, and more difficult for them anyway, to index for SIP, to get these databases indexed. Each one has a graph. You have to relate the graphs. You got to relate the content and index that and pull it all together and then put it in a timeline and try to make sense of it. How do you assess the interactions of groups of people in a timeline? For example, if you're looking at dope smuggling, the person in, say, Colombia wants to sell dope to somebody in the United States. They have to make a connection to agree on the sale. Then the person has to agree on the price, right? And then they have to transfer the money, and they've got to They've got to transport it from Colombia up to the United States, so there's all kinds of transactions that have to occur. All those kind of interactions happen in the communities that they're building, and you have to be able to recognize that. Well, how can you recognize that, right? That's the key, too. They can't do that either yet, not yet, by any means. So they're struggling with that. They're struggling just to find out what's important in the data, let alone put together the and analyze the profiles and what's important in the profiles. We call that profiles of interest is what we call that. We never documented it for them, so they can't do it. But we defined it for them as combinations of things that would imply there was intentions and capabilities to form certain acts, like dope smuggling, arms smuggling, an attack, any kind of thing like that. For example, the 9/11 crowd did a typical military attack profile. They showed that the military profiles will simply be the military moves to positions to prepare for the attack. In other words, there's takeoff positions for the attack. They prepare for the attack by setting up their command and control system, and then they execute the attack from there. But you can see that movement and shuffling to get in position to do that, and that's a pretty typical military action. Well, the terrorists did exactly the same thing. They moved to hotels next to airports and then got on the bought the tickets for the airplanes and then got on the airplanes simultaneously. So you could see that buildup. That was an obvious attack coming.
What are some of the things about 9/11, you know, 13 years later, that disturb you that might not have been investigated properly? Or what are some of the anomalies or things that you know, are like a splinter in your mind about 9/11?
Well, in the intelligence arena, there's, of course, the inadequate search of the database that NSA did. And after the fact, they found the data and then covering it up and not letting it be exposed to the congressional investigations or the 9/11 commission, to my knowledge, anyway. So that meant that they didn't have those aspects to deal with and couldn't deal with it in terms of their reports or in their studies. And so and then there's the physical issues. You know, I've been talking to some physicists recently and engineers and so on, and they have a coalition of people, the 9/11 Truth Group, which is saying there are certain aspects of 9/11, the physical nature of how the things occurred, that should have been addressed by these different studies and have not been physical things, observable acts like the like molten metal in the buildings coming out of the buildings, and like that certain temperatures have to, physics require certain temperatures for that to occur, and how you can't get that kind of temperature in a fire in a building like
that. So you can't identify the source of what's causing that.
Right. But that's a physical fact that should have been addressed and dealt with. And also Building 7 falling straight on its footprint, that kind of thing is suspicious. How could a building like that fall that way? And that was not even addressed. So none of those things, or some of the other things they were showing me, were also suspicious that they should have addressed, and they didn't. And so none of the studies came out with those. So that's basically a very bad, even NIST didn't do that. I mean, that's not good science at all. I mean, you don't ignore facts that don't fit your preconceived outcome.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at libertystickers.com. Again, that's libertystickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.